Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space for the war for the free world. In that war, there are few people who have stood up more courageously and been, I think, more effective in warning us about the danger that Islamism poses, not just to the rest of us, but even to Muslims. Himself a Muslim, of course, we're speaking of Dr. Zudi Jasser, a physician in Arizona who has been at the forefront through his own organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, through his writings, through his appearances on Fox and elsewhere, and not least through his very important book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam, An American Muslim Patriot's Fight to Save His Faith. Dr. Jasser, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you again.
Let's talk a little bit initially, at least, about sort of a point of calibration, Zudi. You have been warning for many years about what Islamists have in mind for, as I say, your faith as well as the rest of us. How is that playing out at the moment, as you see it, in Egypt, where Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim brother, is now the president?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, I just came back from there. I was on a trip on behalf of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and we'll have a report on behalf of the commission coming out in May, but I can tell you personally, from my interactions with some of his deputies and people that he has around him, is, you know, we have a lot to be afraid of. The people he's surrounding himself with, you know, we saw a lot of hoopla about his comments that were revealed that he made in 2010, and then he said they were taken out of context, where he described Jews in a very offensive way, obviously exposing his anti-Semitism. But I can tell you the people around him harbor similar ideas. They look upon America and the West in a conspiratorial way and talk about Israel and their role in a very anti-Semitic fashion. They are looking to bring their orbit nearer to the OIC countries. And as much as we may be thinking that continuing to provide some type of support is going to bring us closer to them, I can tell you that that's not necessarily anything that they seem to be caring that much about, as they continue to be unapologetic about trying more cases ever than in the last generation of individuals for supposed blasphemy laws and apostasy laws. And Christians are more afraid than they've ever been living in Cairo, some of the ones that we've talked to about their situation. And unfortunately, some of them are beginning to leave.
Dr. Jasser, one of the things that is you've touched on there, the OIC, or Organization of Islamic Cooperation, a 57-member group, 56 states plus Palestine, Muslim majority. Mohamed Morsi has just become the president of that group for the next 3 years. Do you see this as kind of a convergence between the Muslim Brotherhood and this sort of nation-state level enterprise that that kind of suggests a lurch towards the caliphate, which is, of course, the aspiration of the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, certainly, as they right now are on the verge of economic collapse, they will reach out, and the first place they go to is their Muslim brothers, whether they're Shia, Sunni, or part of this, what I view the OIC to be sort of a neo-caliphate, if you will. But at the end of the day, make no mistake, in the long term, the schism and the sectarian division will continue. Al-Azhar, while the OIC was being hosted, actually on the day we were there, was putting up proclamations about the Shia being deviant. You know, so the old schism will continue. But right now what they do, especially when their economies are suffering, I mean, Morsi, for example, was able to open up now, and the first time in 30 years, he's opened up visas no longer required to travel between Iran. Iran's giving them cut-rate oil, and the economic sharing that's happening is actually quite astounding for the history between those two countries. And the OIC certainly is beginning to unify itself in a sense of alienation against the West. And our fears should be brought to bear as we see them beginning to exaggerate a lot of the conspiracy theories. And meanwhile, our administration has been doing nothing. They've continued to try to appease this group, not only Morsi, but the OIC. And we don't seem to have a strategy other than allowing them to consolidate power, all the while we simply are asleep at the switch. And the liberals, I'll tell you, Frank, the liberals on the ground, the minorities, the Muslims that didn't vote for Morsi, that are trying to do revolution 3.0, they're looking upon us as part of a conspiracy to help the Brotherhood come in. They're looking upon us as abandoning them and not standing for any values of democracy.
Well, there's a lot of reason for that concern, obviously. Dr. Zudi Jasser is our guest. He is a physician, also the founder and president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He is a leader within the Muslim community of those who believe in our Constitution, in our freedoms, and is, as he mentioned, serving on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom now, a very important post, which we're delighted you have. Speaking of the administration and its attitude towards all of this, Zudi Jasser, we are looking at not only, as you mentioned, support for the Brotherhood, in some cases funding it in Egypt, arming it for that matter, and a lot of acquiescence to its agenda of imposing this Sharia blasphemy program, kind of the leading edge of the rest of it, I'm afraid, here in the United States and elsewhere. Quickly, tell us about the attitude of the Obama administration to the Muslim Brotherhood and its outriders in this country, and what it means for you, as you say in the title of your book, you battle for the soul of Islam in this country.
Well, they have really continued to attract themselves to the lowest hanging fruit, which are the Islamists that have addresses in Washington and that have been long funded by petrodollar interests. And, you know, John Brennan is a great example of that. He has long been an apologist for a lot of the Islamist groups. If you look at the counterterrorism strategy that his department at the White House put out, they mentioned the word ideology over 20 times, but never mentioned what that ideology was. And you know, I'm very concerned that now the erstwhile head of the CIA is going to be running an agency that actually has a center called the CIA Center for the Strategic Analysis of Political Islam, and yet he himself has never acknowledged political Islam as a threat, and in fact has aided and allowed the growth and given a platform to Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups like the Islamic Society of North America, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and especially the Muslim Public Affairs Council. And what that does is it makes groups like ours and our coalition, the American Islamic Leadership Coalition, that are struggling to get platforms against these groups, makes us seem irrelevant. And meanwhile, the government provides, in a tribal sense, they become the de facto leaders of the Muslim community in America, whether we want them to be or not.
Yeah. This is really such a key point, Dr. Jasser. And is there any doubt in your mind that the people that the administration is overwhelmingly reaching out to are, in fact, aligned with the, if not actually, agents of the Muslim Brotherhood? And give us just a quick further burst on what this means for the Muslim American community if they're being held up, these folks, as their leaders.
I really don't have any doubt, because if you look at the materials coming out of the White House, there's no criticism of Islamism. They actually now are controlling the lexicon, and they don't want us to use the terms at all, which is right out of the playbook of all Islamists, is that if you attack Islamism, you attack Islam, and thus you stifle free speech, which clearly the policy of the administration could might as well have been written by the Brotherhood. So, you know, whether they're agents or not, it doesn't matter. The policies of the White House seem to be articulating what the Brotherhood would want in the West. So I think that speaks for itself. And then as far as reformers, whether it's, you know, people can go to AmericanIslamicLeadership.org and look at the list of individuals that are doing the work against these Islamist groups. We really have a very difficult chance in taking on these guys, because when the government doesn't pay attention to us, the media doesn't pay attention, and then the Muslim minority in America circles the wagons around the groups that are lifted up. And, you know, if you look to, I'll tell you, some of the beings we went with in Egypt with the Brotherhood, a lot of their assistants are Americans. were educated here that are now back there, went back to Egypt to help build this government. And I can tell you, if you want American Muslims to play a positive role in this Arab awakening to shift it away from Islamism, you have to start acknowledging our existence and helping us build platforms against these petrodollar organizations.
Amen. Dr. Jesser, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your superb work, your construction, as well as your courage. We look forward to your testimony before the Helsinki Commission in Washington this week on anti-Semitism and Islamism. Next up, Robert Mazur, a hero in the fight against money laundering. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Robert Mazur, a man who I have not had the privilege of meeting, but I have been extraordinarily impressed by in terms of the courage that he's exhibited and the accomplishments in the course of really distinguished, if covert, service to his country. These are documented to some degree in his book, The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. Robert Mazur, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's a great treat to have you with us, and congratulations on such extraordinary service.
Well, thank you very much. There's a lot of I get the opportunity to continually deal with public servants who are working with the government, and the good news is that there's some extraordinarily bright and brave men and women out there who are working for us every day.
There are indeed, and their praises are not sung often enough, I think, and so it's nice to be able to do that with you. Tell us a little bit about your experiences in penetrating and countering some of the operations that have specifically used money laundering techniques to the detriment of America's national interests and even its security.
Sure. Well, you know, I was a federal agent for 27 years, and five of those I was a long-term undercover agent. So that basically is a volunteer position where you immerse yourself within the underground. And in this instance, and I didn't do that, you know, overnight. I had been an agent for 14 years, and I had a considerable amount of exposure working on international drug trafficking and money laundering cases. So to assume the role of a money launderer within the
the cartel with the help of a series of informants and being embedded in some active real businesses, you know, finance company, mortgage brokerage business, an air charter service with a private jet, a jewelry chain with 70 locations on the East Coast, and even a brokerage firm with a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. So I didn't have to be the very best undercover agent. I had a lot of resources. I was blessed with a lot of great training and mentors, including the likes of Joe Pistone, who the book and movie Donnie Brasco is based on. And I got the opportunity to deal with some of the most ruthless individuals within the Medellin cartel, many of whom reported directly to Pablo Escobar. I dealt with his principal consigliere, who was a lawyer to the rest of the world, and somebody who dealt with the legislature in Colombia enacting new laws and practicing law. But in fact, he was a very ruthless person who could, on a given day, order the death and did, in fact, in my presence, order the death of individuals. These are people who, unfortunately for us, provide a huge supply of illegal drugs to our population that, unfortunately, has the most insatiable appetite of any population on this planet for illegal drugs, but the money that is generated is astounding. Roughly $400 billion a year just from the sale of illegal drugs, and about $65 billion of that being generated within our borders. So it's not surprising to see that there also another thing that that we documented, I think, vividly, was the active involvement of certain segments of the international banking and business communities that market this type of money and make substantial profits from it. I became a conduit for the cartel with what was then the seventh largest privately held bank in the world, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And I think the most interesting thing about the bank and about other banks that are involved in this type of activity is that they don't solicit deposits from one sector of the criminal underground. They really market any money seeking secrecy from governments. So it can be money from drug trafficking, arms dealing, pilfering treasuries, tax evasion, busting sanctions, any other type of illegal type transaction where the same skill set is needed in order to make that money look legal. And that was very, very evident.
Let me ask a question on this, because I what you've described is an extraordinarily sort of complicated subject, I think, for probably most of our purposes. And yet what it really comes down to is just a couple of words: follow the money. If you're trying to figure out what these banking institutions are doing, we're going to talk a little bit about their role in circumventing sanctions with Jonathan Schanzer in a moment. But tell us about how, just in the most rudimentary way, this kind of concealment of the sources and uses of funds takes place, and the purposes that it's enabling bad guys to advance.
Well, you know, we've got a number of cases that have happened very recently that are identical to the type of activity that I got to see and record when I dealt with the senior officers of BCCI, the most recent of which is, of course, the HSBC, or Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation scandal. And in that instance, they admitted to the fact that they had been involved in the laundering of $881 million for both the Sinaloa cartel, which is the largest one in Mexico, and the Norte de Valle cartel. And you can see from a number of reports, and I think probably one of the best is one that was issued by a Senate subcommittee that Senator Levin is the chairman of, that your listeners can Google, and they can see the various techniques that were used to make all of this illegal money look as legal as they possibly could. And when it came to busting sanctions, they even counseled banks in Iran on how they could structure their wire transfers. It's basically a technique called stripping wire transfers, where you would take the information that's otherwise lawfully required off and insert other misleading information on those wire transfers, so they won't be picked up in the filters that are otherwise established by institutions in the United States and won't be seen by the U.S. government. I mean, there is a very, very scary connection that we all must be very, very mindful of, and that's an alliance between not just the Mexican and the Colombian cartels, but the Mexican and Colombian cartels working with terrorist organizations, and in particular, some very, very recent cases documenting the intricate involvement of Hezbollah with the Mexican and Colombian cartels. There's a case, the last name of which is Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A. So if your listeners Google Juma, J-O-U-M-A-A, in drug trafficking or money laundering, they're going to see some very, very detailed documents, including the indictments and charts that were put out by the U.S. Treasury Department, identifying the businesses around the world that were set up and used by these businessmen in West Africa, which is a key location for the movement of illegal drugs and money, and also in places like Colombia and Panama and Lebanon. And so this problem that relates to the involvement, the knowing involvement of international banks in the laundering of this money, directly relates to our national security and really deserves much more attention than it's been getting.
I couldn't agree with you more. Our guest again is Robert Mazur. He is a nearly three-decade-long civil servant in the United States government, a former federal agent who went deep undercover in Colombia and elsewhere in pursuit of this quest of following the money that some of these very dangerous actors are using to our detriment. He's currently president of Chase & Associates, an agency that provides enhanced due diligence and other services to law firms and banks and the like that want to avoid these kinds of pitfalls, I imagine. Robert, let me quickly ask you, what would you recommend we do to curb this kind of phenomenon, especially, as you say, the use now being made of it by terrorist organizations?
Yes, well, I've written a number of articles about this, and in January of this year, there was the last one was published in the New York Times, and I've been writing articles on this for the last 3 or 4 years. But I sincerely believe that what our country has been doing, what the Department of Justice has been doing with respect to the criminal activities of international banks falls far short of what needs to be done. Basically, what our Department of Justice strategy has been is to find the banks. Very few people, if any, are prosecuted, no individual officers. If you look at the HSBC case, the former head of the criminal division, thankfully no longer there and resigned, in Lanny Brewer, was proud of a $1.9 billion fine that was assessed against HSBC. But if you look very closely at HSBC, just in 1 year, in 2010, that $1.9 billion represents one-tenth of their net profits pre-tax just for that year alone. And they had this conduct going on for decades. So I really do believe that, number one of the things that needs to be done is to identify the individuals within the banking community that are responsible for this activity and individually prosecute them. I think that there are other things that can actively be done by our law enforcement agencies that unfortunately at this stage aren't really being done, and that's a proactive involvement in trying to identify and prosecute the officers of banks or the executives of businesses that launder this type of money. When we did it back in the BCCI case that I wrote the book about, I was undercover, actively recording conversations with senior bank officials behind closed boardroom doors, capturing the evidence at the time of the transactions of exactly what their intent was. The cases that we seem to see now are generally brought about through historical look-backs that are being done by regulators. And when you're in there and you're looking at something on paper that was done 3 and 4 years ago, it is extraordinarily difficult for anyone to develop the evidence.
Hard to follow the money when it's old money and long since gone. Robert Mazur, we've got to let you go. Thank you very much for both what you've done for our country and your continuing service. The book he's written is The Infiltrator, My Secret Life Inside the Dirty Banks, Behind Pablo Escobar's Medellin Cartel. I hope you'll come back to us for a further visit soon. Next up, we're going to visit with Jonathan Schanzer, as I mentioned, about how the Iranians are circumventing sanctions through some of these same money laundering techniques. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put 10 bucks away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tomorrow, the United States Senate will decide whether Chuck Hagel should be the next Secretary of Defense. If it does so, that job will go to a man who believes, among other things, that U.S. forces should be inserted into the West Bank as a means of facilitating the creation of a Palestinian state there. The best that can be said about such a deployment is that it will embroil the United States directly in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. More likely, the U.S. forces will wind up protecting jihadists from Israeli defensive measures. That is particularly the case given Mr. Hagel's well-documented hostility towards the Jewish state. If you haven't already let your senators know that America needs a better Secretary of Defense than Chuck Hagel, please let them know today. And if you have, please do it again. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize Shaq's mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jonathan Schanzer. He is Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a man who has been writing about, thinking about, and engaged very directly in the public policy debate about the Middle East for many years. Dr. Schanzer has, among other things to his credit, been involved with the book Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine and Al-Qaeda's Armies, Middle East Affiliate Groups and the Next Generation of Terror. Jonathan, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking in the previous segment with Robert Mazur about money laundering as a means of circumventing sanctions. You at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy and your colleagues have done a wonderful job of helping increase the teeth in the sanctions that have been adopted thus far. And yet you've been writing with some concern about what's going on in Europe at the moment that suggests some sort of money laundering is going on there to circumvent sanctions that the Europeans are supposed to be honoring. Give us a flavor of that, if you can, and what it might mean for the Iranian regime to be getting through that sort of cutout.
Sure. Well, I think a bit of context first. You'll probably recall that last year the U.S. Congress put a great deal of pressure on a consortium known as SWIFT, which has this proprietary technology that allows banks to transfer money. It's a settlement program that allows, so if I wanted to transfer money to you, Frank, I would have to use the program on my end and you would use it on yours. Banks would communicate and funds are debited and credited.
Right. As I recall, this was a technique that was rather closely held as a means of monitoring these flows and was compromised, as I recall, by the New York Times. Am I right?
Yes. Some time ago, it was allegedly being used by the Treasury. for intelligence gathering. But at the end of the day, we looked at that as a key component that Iran always had to use in order to make transactions in the formal banking sector. At the time, however, we left out another key component, and that is a platform known as Target 2. It is owned and controlled by the European Central Bank, so basically it is subject to EU jurisdiction. And so we found that while the SWIFT transactions were being blocked, and I think they'd been doing a good job of that, we had overlooked this European component. And recently we have heard from government sources that the Iranians have been amassing as much of their liquid holdings as possible into euros. And the implication here is that they're preparing to make major transactions in euro. And the way to stop that would be to ensure that Target 2 shuts down their system in the same way that SWIFT does. We don't have any specific knowledge of how much it's been used to date, but it's fairly clear that if the Iranians have any euro holdings, they automatically have to use Target 2 as their settlement platform.
So it is really important to get our hands around this particular problem. And yet what we've found in Europe, as you've been writing about, Dr. Jonathan Schanzer, is a blind spot, not just towards the Iranians, but even towards their proxy, a designated terrorist organization, Hezbollah. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, obviously, we know that the Bulgarians recently came out with this report linking Hezbollah inextricably to that Burgas bombing over the summer. And, the idea was that that, of course, would push the Europeans to make a designation of Hezbollah. Instead, what we found is a lot of foot dragging. A lot of the other European countries, the French in particular, are apparently rather skittish. They're afraid of what it might mean if a designation, in fact, comes to pass. Whether that France would be targeted, other parts of Western Europe could potentially be targeted by this Iranian proxy. And so they're looking to potentially designate only the so-called military wing of Hezbollah and not the political wing.
The famous military wing, right.
That's right. This is the two-step here that we're very familiar with. People have done the same thing with Hamas. But we know...
Well, and the hawks and doves in the Kremlin, too, for that matter, back in the old days, right?
That's right. That's right. But I can tell you, as a former intelligence official that used to deal with these issues, I can tell you that you cannot split apart Hamas. You cannot split apart Hezbollah. They exist for one reason and one reason only, and that is to attack Israel and to be basically a striking arm of the Iranian regime. And so the idea that you can somehow split them is a bit preposterous, but yet this is the policy that many in Europe are more comfortable with. For them, it is a compromise, as opposed to, in what I, in my opinion, what would be a really hard-hitting policy that would really isolate Hezbollah. And I should also just note this, that some Israeli military officials and intelligence officials have made it very clear that if you shut down Hezbollah activity in Europe, you would shut down a great deal of their finances, that most of their operations are financed out of Europe.
Well, you're being excessively generous, it seems to me. If the Europeans actually go forward with this idea that there is some distinction that can be drawn and we can see them continue to support a part of the Hezbollah operation, there's no question that it's life support for this terrorist organization, and it will be, as you say, an even greater problem in the future. One of the things, speaking of the future, that we are looking ahead to is the trip by President Obama to the region, including to Israel. You have been, I know, thinking hard about American policy in the region for a long time. There is some talk that the president will be going to try to breathe new life into this so-called peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. And at least some of the people around him have been promoting for some time the idea that U.S. forces, perhaps leading a multinational military contingent, could helpfully, usefully, productively be deployed in the West Bank, let's say, to help effect a transition to a second state in the region, namely a Palestinian state. What are your thoughts about the advisability, not simply the likelihood of it coming forward, but the advisability of doing something like that with U.S. troops?
Sure. Well, it's basically a horrible idea. The idea that first of all, I mean, to think that we just extricated U.S. forces from Afghanistan and Iraq because we couldn't sort of bear the thought of tangling with jihadists, and then to put them right back into the heart of things, where you've got, you know, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, you've got Hamas, you've got popular resistance committees, and a whole group of potentially other nasty groups that could emerge as foes of U.S. forces. It's mind-boggling to think about this, but it's also, I think it's an affront to the Israelis, who pride themselves on being able to defend their own territory and have done an excellent job over the last six decades in doing so. And it's also an affront, quite frankly, to the Palestinian security forces. We've invested quite a bit, I think, against some of our better judgment in the past, to ensure that these forces can properly defend the Palestinian Authority. You know, what we should be doing is encouraging both sides to work out an agreement on their own. And if now is not the time, then we should just be doing everything that we can to ensure that there is calm without putting our own forces on the ground. This is the last thing we need to do. We do not need to put to inject ourselves any more than we already have.
Yeah. I just want to run a proposition past you, Jonathan Schanzer, because you have, as I said, been a student of this for a long time, including, I would guess, in your service in the Department of the Treasury, where you were working on counterterrorism issues. But if we were to put our troops in the midst of this melee, it seems to me at the very least you can expect that they will be targeted by some of the people that you've identified, terrorists, jihadists, whatever you want to call them. But what are the chances beyond that that they would wind up, as a practical matter, providing protection, let me say, for the Palestinian jihadists against Israeli defensive measures, bringing us really into very, very strong conflict, I suspect, if not military, certainly political, strategic, with our closest friends in the region?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. If you look at basically what's happening in Lebanon right now with UNIFIL, the UN forces, what often happens is the Israelis need to coordinate with them and almost ask for permission in order to carry out operations. The last thing that we want to do is to find ourselves where we need to coordinate with the Israelis every time the Israelis need to do something in order to protect their own. So, you know, I think just, again, a bad idea all around. I have to say that I have not heard that this idea is gaining a whole lot of traction. I think that you want to talk about red lines. You know, we hear a lot about those when it comes to the Iranian nuclear program. I think that this in general would be a red line for the Israelis. I think it would be very difficult to have that even get off the ground.
Well, but I hope you're right. Jonathan, I'm out of time. I just have to let you go at that. I think you're absolutely right. It would be a bad idea, and I hope it would be a red line, and I hope we won't see the administration promoting it. But we'll stay on it, as I know you will be. Dr. Jonathan Schanzer is our guest. He has written one of his recent publications with Mark Dubowitz, his Palestinian Pulse, What Policymakers Can Learn from Palestinian Social Media. Next up, we will be talking with Gordon Chang about the latest from North Korea and the threats to the South and beyond. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Up in the morning and out to school.
Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, the man we turn to each week at this hour to visit about what's going on in Asia. He is the duty expert, not just for us, but for Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. Also, very frequent guest of Fox News and a man who I think generally is recognized as one of the country's leading experts on the issues that are likely to challenge the security of this country and our friends and allies throughout the Western Pacific in the years ahead. Gordon Chang, welcome back. It's always great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, there's some noise out of North Korea that sounds as though, once again, they are threatening the destruction of their neighbors to the south. I gather the pretext at the moment is the U.S. is planning to conduct with the South Koreans long-scheduled military training exercises. Is there something new going on here, Gordon? Is it something that we should be more worried than usual about with respect to the North?
Pyongyang threatened the quote-unquote final destruction of South Korea. And although many people would dismiss this as rhetoric, which it probably is, nonetheless, it is true that within 2 months of the inauguration of a South Korean president, North Korea always commits a provocation of some sort. And yesterday we had the inauguration of Park Geun-hye as the new South Korean president. So clearly there's going to be something occurring in the not-too-distant future. And we got 28,500 troops on the Korean peninsula, so we've got to be concerned about our security as well.
To the extent that the Chinese are enabling North Korea, what should we make, Gordon, of the fact that they've put out through their propaganda arms the claim that while the North Koreans are being badly behaved, it's really the fault of the United States? What does that tell us about both, you know, the Chinese and their North Korean clients and about their reliability, the Chinese, in the hope for management of this North Korean problem that we've seen in Washington for successive administrations?
Yeah. Going back to the administration of George W. Bush, there's been great hope in Washington that the Chinese would solve the North Korean problem for us. And that clearly has not panned out. The Chinese, going back to the beginning of the Korean War, have blamed the United States for problems on the Korean Peninsula. I think what is significant about the most recent propaganda from Beijing about the United States being the one to blame for North Korea's provocations is it shows that there has really been almost no change in China's official position. This idea that we're responsible for the ballistic missile programs and the nuclear detonations of North Korea is in one sense laughable, but I think that it points out a more fundamental problem with our whole notion that China is on our side when it comes to North Korea.
Gordon Chang is, of course, the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and indeed it is doing so with the help and assent, clearly, of communist China. Gordon, one of the things that we've talked about a lot with you over the years and that has now seemingly achieved a new level of prominence with a report issued last week by a group called Mandian that was picked up in the New York Times describing communist China's aggressive, sustained, disciplined, and it seems highly successful use of hackers and cyber techniques to get into government and commercial computer networks. Is there any new revelation contained in this, or is it simply that the documentation of it is particularly dispositive?
The Mandian 74-page report details at a level of specificity that we have not seen attribution of these cyber attacks to China's People's Liberation Army. We've known for about a decade that the PLA has been behind cyber attacks on American networks. But what's really changed, I think, recently is public's perception of this. This has occurred for a very long time, and there's been very little response from Washington, which is, of course, disappointing. But the attacks on the New York Times, and Mandiant is a New York Times contractor that helped the paper try to fend off these attacks. The attacks on the New York Times, I think, have really been a tipping point in public opinion. And now people are starting to understand the broad-based nature of what China is doing. They're not only going after defense networks, they're going after American companies and American NGOs. So they're going after the institutions of a free society. This is not just some attempt to find information from the Pentagon. This is an attempt to undermine America itself.
Yeah, it really constitutes cyber warfare, not simply some sort of nuisance factor. And the tipping point presumably is especially profoundly felt, of course, by the New York Times, which can help make it a more popular perception as well, Gordon Chang, as you know. To the extent that there is now no doubt that Communist China is behind this. They've, as we've discussed before, sometimes suggested that these are rogue hackers and they have no involvement in the matter. But it would seem, Gordon, to require a much more robust and vigorous response by the Obama administration than we've seen to date. How would you characterize that response? And is it, in fact, as feckless as it seems?
I think the Obama administration is really at a loss of what to do. And this really is a problem that goes back to Nixon's trip to China, where the United States has wanted to engage the Chinese. During the first term of the Obama administration, the president himself Secretary of Defense Panetta and other officials have talked to the Chinese about cyber hacking, but it really hasn't worked because these attacks from China spiked dramatically in the middle of last year. So the administration's response has not been adequate. But also, this is a problem not just with the administration, but also with Congress. As late as last November, the Senate turned down a cyber bill, which in itself was inadequate, but they turned it down as well. Which is even worse. I think what we really need to do is have a broad-based reassessment of the threat that China poses to American institutions. And this has to be not only across Washington, but across the United States as well, because the Chinese really do mean to undermine us.
Yeah, and it really is. The technique of choice is cyber war, but the emphasis is on war. Let me ask you, part of the reason that this takes on such a moment, Gordon, as we've discussed often, is the rising power and seemingly now increasing independence of the Chinese military. To the extent that Chinese consumption seems to be declining, and there are other indicators you mentioned in a recent column, Foxconn, one of the important manufacturing units for Apple's products and others, now beginning to bail out of China. What does all this portend in terms of the future direction of the Communist Party and the country it rules?
Well, the Chinese economy is fragile. The recovery that we've seen since the fourth quarter of last year seems to be stalling. This really is an issue because it makes communist leaders in Beijing not only arrogant, but also insecure. And I think that what we're seeing is the Chinese military breaking free of civilian control. We have civilian leaders, I think, pretty much at a really following the tune of the military because they don't have an independent power base of their own. And so what we're seeing right now is a political system in disarray and one in which is becoming much more arrogant. We saw President Obama exercise restraint in support of Japan as Prime Minister Abe was in Washington. And what do the Chinese do? They pay back that restraint with in further intrusions into Japanese waters on Sunday. So clearly, we have a Chinese political system that's becoming much more arrogant and an American political system that doesn't know how to react.
But Gordon, and very quickly, that would seem to be cause and effect, wouldn't you say, that if the United States is exercising restraint, it's signaling weakness to the Chinese, at least as they perceive it, and that's to be exploited in this this kind of direct and increasingly arrogant fashion?
Absolutely, Frank. And then we've seen this in the first term of the Obama administration, where officials such as Secretary Clinton tried to signal cooperation, and the Chinese saw that as a sign of weakness and then pressed the advantage. The administration should learn from this because clearly the Chinese do not react well to signs of friendship.
Well, signs of friendship that aren't justified, I think, is really the point. Gordon Chang, as always, your insights are deeply appreciated by us, and we're delighted to share you with Fox News and Forbes.com and World Affairs Journal. We look forward to visiting with you again next week, and we look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks so much for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.